the membership gave us a sustainable income that didn't rely on brands, but actually put Black women first in terms of we have to make the membership the best it is. So Black women actually pay us. And then the flip side of that is by having a paywall, we're actually protecting Black writers, Black female writers who don't get opportunities to kind of write about their stories or interview people that they want. They get to do that in a safe space as well.
Welcome to Media Voices, everybody. We're the Media Focus podcast that takes a wry look at all the news and views from around the media world this week. Unfortunately, there has been no news this week, so you'll have to do with our analysis of basically one story. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
And that extract you just heard is from Toby Oridan, who is co-founder and CEO of Black Ballad, which is a UK-based lifestyle platform for Black British women. So I spoke to her about what drove her to found the site, how they launched their memberships ahead of the curve in 2016, and what they're doing with their future news funding to better serve their audience outside of London. And I absolutely love this chat. This has been one of my highlights from the last couple of months. Yeah, I don't want to spoil it too much. I'll just let you listen to what she has to say after we chat about what I think is quite a big story.
Well, Peter, your hatred of platform stories is well documented, but this one actually has a couple of interesting wrinkles that make it apply to media and news publishers as well.
I'm not going to try and explain this story because Es is going to do a much better job than that. I am actually going to explain why I think this story is, despite it being a pain in the ass, worth talking about.
Okay, cool. Esther, the gauntlet has been thrown down. What is this big story we're talking about?
I'm just going to say also, we're recording this Sunday evening. The speed at which this has been moving, this might all have changed tomorrow, so who knows?
Yeah, very probably.
But Trump, as of about 9 hours ago, has given his blessing to last-minute revisions of a TikTok, Oracle, Walmart deal. Where did that come from? In order to keep the social media app operational in the US. Peter, why do we care about this?
Well, because the people using TikTok are the future audiences of any publisher anywhere in the world. It's got 500 million users or something, and they're all, largely speaking, they're all very young. They're Gen Z. And the uptake, certainly prior to lockdown, of publishers on the platform was really pretty interesting. People went for it. You know, a lot of newspapers were using it. TikTok was trying to court publishers by offering them some decent cash, allegedly. So there is a media angle on this. Why I find it so frustrating is just the utter bullshit.
At the start of August, just as we went on holiday, Trump ordered Chinese-owned TikTok to be banned in the US. He gave them like a month to sort things out, and he said it's because of national security concerns around data and data sharing, and he was worried that the Chinese government are using. So TikTok then sued the Trump administration in response to the ban. That's ongoing. They then were working with Microsoft, Oracle, and like a number of other really random companies to try and find a way to continue operations. They proposed a deal last week between TikTok and Oracle after Microsoft backed out. That was rejected on Friday evening by the Trump administration because it didn't go far enough with the security thing. And then for some inexplicable reason over the weekend, Walmart has got involved. Oracle are now going to deal with the data and host all the data themselves, and it has got the theoretical thumbs up.
So now, presumably that the book has been closed and the deal is... it's going to see the end. No. And the establishment now of a new company dubbed TikTok Global, with a majority of American dictators.
America!
Directors, not dictators.
Did I say dictators?
Yes.
Wow.
That's a Freudian
slip. Oh my God. Headquartered in the US with a majority of American directors, a US chief executive and a security expert on the board, presumably from the US of States as well. And I also heard that the US of States, and they have to salute the flag every morning and recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
The thing is, though, that this deal does need to be signed off by the Chinese government, who have so far issued a number of statements about how the US is bullying them.
Also, there's something about ByteDance, who's the owner of TikTok, has just been told that there's a £5 billion education fund associated with the deal, and ByteDance is like,
So ByteDance found out about this after Trump announced it at a rally on Saturday.
I saw that.
This is not in the agreement. In other things Trump has said about this deal that aren't entirely factually correct, he said that the new TikTok company will be totally controlled by Oracle and Walmart. That is not true. They are actually only investing to acquire 20% of TikTok Global, and ByteDance is retaining a share of the majority share of the US operation.
Yeah, but to his base, he's defeated China. China has been defeated by the great China. Defeated by the great Lord Trump.
Next we can take on the China virus.
However, this isn't the end of the Chinese app blocking saga, because this deal doesn't affect WeChat.
Hooray!
I think as of the time this goes, is it available to download as of the time we go live, or is that now being overturned?
Well, so they were supposedly banning it at midnight tonight US time. A federal judge said that was unconstitutional and ruled against it. So there's a temporary block on the block.
And also the TikTok deal only is still not fully approved until the 27th of September. honestly, by the time this goes live, like I said, this could have all changed again.
Just even if the TikTok thing came into place, it's not actually going to start until after the election.
And it also doesn't make a difference if you've already got the app downloaded.
Okay, so here's a big question, kiddies.
Yep.
Why is he bothering? Why is he putting so much effort into this?
I mean, which of the many reasons do you want? It's because he doesn't have a presence on it. It's because younger people are using it to share pro-Biden messages. It's so he can say to his base he's defeated China. It's because he doesn't understand it and he just wants to say he's got a victory.
It was the TikTok kids that bought all the tickets to that rally, wasn't it?
They totally blew up his million person rally and about four people showed up.
Okay, I'm not going to back Trump up here.
Oh, here we go.
But there are legitimate data security concerns that, you know, we need to have a conversation around.
Yeah, 100%. They could sell it to Cambridge Analytica.
And there are also links to this. Do you guys remember the I can never pronounce this, the Huawei ban?
Yeah.
Which happened last year, and that ended up... That again was similar things where they were concerned about the amount of Chinese interference in it.
Their argument is that ByteDance will take all this data and hand it to the Chinese Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
But the Chinese Communist Party's already got all that shit anyway. It's like, seriously? Same as the Russians have already got it all.
The thing is, I think because of the way this has been handled, it's hard to see this as a serious conversation when it's being used as a political football. When they banned Huawei, Washington banned US firms from doing business with Huawei and all allies to ban it from their 5G network. So the UK had already done their risk assessment on it and said, yeah, we're all right to go ahead. And then they realised that they couldn't then get a deal with the US over anything else because the US had banned Huawei and banned allies from using it. So it's we could see a similar thing where the US ends up putting pressure on people it works with to also reject these apps.
Well, then it's just
a mess.
So then they've just broke the internet, right?
But you know, you've got all the US publishers that started experimenting on the platform. Yeah. They'd invested money into TikTok teams that have now, you know, they're like, is this actually going to go? You know, is this going to be live when they get into work on Monday?
The experiments I saw from publishers on TikTok, it was very much like early stage stuff. You know, it was kind of brand awareness. It was brand building rather than,
I don't think anyone spent huge amounts of money on it.
But as with any platform, there is a cost involved in actually tailoring content to it. To suddenly have it, like, thrown back in your face just because...
But also imagine this the other way around. Imagine China said, we're not going to allow this company, this US company into... You know, and behind
Facebook,
our
WhatsApp,
firewall.
Like, exactly. There's a whole range of things they could back.
And how up. Many? How much time have they spent complaining about that?
I guess the fear it could escalate into a massive like digital trade war.
Oh, hooray! I can't fucking wait to be one of the casualties of the first digital trade war when suddenly SoundCloud has to pick a side, and we end up only in China. Can't wait for that.
I can speak a few words of Cantonese.
Okay, so that's good. All right, so we're set. But what about the other podcasts that don't have a, you know, bilingual Cantonese speaker on the podcast?
Bilingual, two words in any language. I hope next week we're talking about something interesting.
No, we'll be talking about job cuts next week.
Oh, God.
Sorry, Peter, I've already looked down at our sort of like media shill Illuminati calendar. And next week is why Boris Johnson's great. And then the week after that's more job cuts.
And now onto the news in brief. We'll start with another platform story. Sorry, guys. Apple has officially announced its Apple One subscription bundle, which brings together music, TV, plus... I'm struggling with what's plus and what isn't. Arcade and News Plus products. But News Plus is only actually included as part of the Prices bundle. We'll link in the notes to a piece from Neiman Lab about from Joshua Benton, who explains how it's unlikely to hugely boost subscription revenue for News Plus publisher partners. So
this is a story about all the extra stuff that people won't buy from Apple.
Yep.
Right. Got it. So, in traditional Australian straight-to-the-point style, News Corp has accused Google of misleading Australian regulators. According to documents filed with regulators in Canberra, News Corp has taken particular issue with Google's claim that it made $10 million Australian dollars. I don't know what Google's total revenue is at this point, but significantly more than $10 million Australian dollars from ads against news queries in Australia. The statement on this is brilliant.
What is that?
This is the Australian part of it. On its face, it's an extraordinary figure. It implies that every Australian user of Google Search is undertaking nearly 100 queries every day of the year, which is plainly more than is actually being conducted by Australian internet users. The point with that is not a number of searches. The point with that is the money, the amount of money.
The first time I've seen News Corp sit there with their hands, holding their hands up, being like, we don't make that much money.
Yeah. The problem is, I think it might actually be slightly different in Australia, but as with the UK and the US, the kind of the illiteracy of the policymakers around, you know, and the opacity of the platforms means that it's actually fairly difficult for them to make an informed decision about who is delivering value to who. Yeah. Well, speaking of Google, Google has just announced a global program to help news publishers navigate the complexity of digital transformation. So the Google News Initiative Digital Growth Program is free, and it's aimed at helping small and mid-sized news publishers around the world develop the capabilities required to accelerate the growth of their businesses online. We need to see what this will look like ultimately, because to my knowledge, this is either just an extension of what the Google News Initiative was already doing, or it's a more of a partnership. And so we need to see more of the particulars about this.
Anyway, so the New York Times and Facebook have struck a multi-year partnership to develop augmented reality filters in effect on Instagram. This is to help users access and contextualize the NYT's journalism. I will put a link to the Axios story in this because I couldn't make head or tail of this.
I like it. I think it's a really good idea. I mean, AR is...
Of course you do.
Well, AR isn't going anywhere. I hop on around
VR. That's the point.
VR.
Hasn't been AR going anywhere for years.
But with kind of this kind of investment and the more AR-enabled platforms that we have, and we are going to get them, this is going to be really useful a couple of years down the line, and it's important to do this groundwork now.
Well, hopefully back in time to help the newspapers, because PwC's Media Outlook report of 20 to 24... Can you imagine trying to write that report this year? Jesus Christ. The report's out and predicts that global newspaper advertising will decline, who knew, by more than a quarter over the next 5 years. It also suggests that global circulation and subscriber revenue will fall from $58.7 billion in 2019 to $50.4 billion in 2024, a decline of 6%. That makes no sense.
How do you mean?
Because people are growing circulation revenues.
I think, but we talk about the bigger ones. If you look at the kind of the bigger newspaper chains, that's where we're going to see that decline.
$8 billion is going to drop from that.
I think so. I mean, if you think about whether
I'm with Peter. I actually think the increase in people's propensity to pay, as Reuters puts it, is actually going to increase that. I stand corrected if we're still talking about this in 4 years' time. But
get
I
a Google alert on 2024.
Yeah,
that just doesn't seem... I mean, I could, you know, 3%, 2%, but 6%, I don't know.
Meanwhile, the BBC has failed to reach an ambitious target to close the gender pay gap by 2020. The fact it's described as ambitious is f***ing infuriating. So its median pay gap currently stands at 6.2%, which is significantly better than the national average, but it's not good enough for an organisation that's supposed to be representative.
Not good enough, BBC.
Nope. And
sort yourselves out.
It also comes out at the time where a bunch of organisations have flagged that there is just no black representation on the BBC for like day on day on day on day. And it's just not good enough.
The company that wrote this this piece, I would be very interested to see their own gender pay gap statistics, because there's a little bit of throwing stones at glass houses here.
That's
but anyway.
Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I'll just leave the link in the show notes. And finally, the Telegraph Media Group have grown their digital subscription revenues, there we are, Peter, by half to £17.8 million in 2019. They attribute the growth to the success of their focus on a subscription-first strategy and, these are three words I really enjoy saying, investment in journalism.
Yes!
When was the last time you heard an organisation that was doing well not say it was investing in its journalism?
Yep.
What does that mean in practice? They just canned a bunch of video
journalists.
It means
people have been listening to this podcast, though, because we've been banging on about this for about 4 years.
Anyway, that's a great news story.
Actually, do you know what? What I find really silly is when people say, we grew our subscriptions because we've had a subscription-first strategy. Well, yeah. If you had a subscription-first strategy and you didn't grow your subscriptions, you'd be definitely doing something wrong, right?
Yeah. It's kind of circular logic.
And you know what? I've just realised.
What?
PwC's Media Outlook Report 2024.
Yeah.
We'll have to check that right at the end of Trump's second term.
Yeah.
No, Peter.
Oh, that's the quietest I've heard you two for ages.
This week I spoke to Black Ballad co-founder Toby Oridan about their business model, building a community, and their future expansion plans. I started by asking her what drove her to start Black Ballad back in 2014.
I co-founded Black Ballad in 2014 with Bola Wani, who is not just my co-founder, my husband, and was my boyfriend at the time. And it really came from a place of passionate frustration. I am a journalist, I guess you would say, by trade. I worked at a lot of like women's weeklies and monthlies and entertainment magazines. And I just realised that black women were just so absent in the newsrooms and even on the pages of publications. We were just neglected by like the whole sort of media world, like women's lifestyle world. Like, it was like kind of black women didn't exist. And if we did, we kind of existed as props in terms of to prop up white women. So you might get one black woman in like a photo shoot to kind of make it look diverse, or, you know, we were kind of misrepresented. So I was just kind of like, If no one's speaking to black women through women's media, then there is an opportunity here and I think I should do it. And I guess with that frustration and just being so passionate about the experiences of black women, because I am a black woman, I was also freelancing a lot and I couldn't get a permanent job. I'd apply for loads of jobs and I wasn't getting any. And I started to do this thing, you know, when you apply for a lot of jobs, you start to see who got the job. Like, yeah. You know, you go for the interview and then you kind of realise who did get the job. And I'd look at who got the jobs and I think language has come so far in 7 years. And every person that got the job was a white woman who was extremely skinny, like early 20s, and like kind of looked very similar, if I'm honest. And I didn't quite have the language to kind of think of why. Why was I not getting the job? And I was just, but all I knew was, there was sort of a similarity between women that were in these magazines. And I remember thinking about being an intern or, you know, being on shift as a freelancer. And these women looked very similar. And, you know, I, being completely honest now, I just didn't fit what, you know, a staff writer, a women's magazine looked like at that time. And not being able to put into language, but knowing there was a barrier that I was up against that I couldn't quite articulate, meant, okay, if no one's going to give me a job, and not because I'm talented, because I think you have to kind of have, I guess, some confidence at one point to move on in terms of, I knew I was talented, I knew I was a great writer, I knew I had great ideas, but yet no one could see it. And I was kind of like, if no one can see what I'm offering, if I can see that everybody looks alike and I don't look like these women who are getting these jobs, I need to change tactics. I need to, you know, our favorite word in media is I need to pivot. And I decided to start Black Ballad because I wanted to give myself a job. I kind of thought if no one's going to take a chance on me, I might as well take a chance on myself. And I also knew there was a gap. Black magazines weren't talking to Black women in the way that I wanted to be spoken to. And, you know, Black women in my life also kind of echoed this sentiment. So I guess those three things of being frustrated with what I could see going on in women's lifestyle media, knowing that I wasn't going to get a job, but not being able to articulate why, and knowing that nothing was out there that was talking to me as a Black woman, all kind of came together for Black Ballad to be kind of birthed in 2014.
And was it something you always had in mind that you wanted to grow it to be a mainstream publication? You didn't kind of want to just write for, you know, almost do like a blog and then evolve it. You wanted to go straight in as this is going to be a proper publication.
I did have a blog, actually. I actually had a Tumblr account called Brown Ballad.
Good old Tumblr.
Tumblr, yeah. I used to kind of blog there, and I used to blog on WordPress as well. So I had a Tumblr account and a WordPress account, Brown Ballad. And the thing is, I realised that my opinions didn't represent every Black woman. Mm. And that was why I knew that it needed to be a fully fledged media company. It couldn't just be based on my opinions and values as a Black woman, because like all categories of women or you know, like identities, there's always nuance. So I was like, yeah, it can't just be me. It just can't be my thoughts or feelings and opinions. I want it to be a diverse range of Black women who are speaking to another set of another diverse range of Black women.
And what made you look at membership as a funding option back in 2016? Because I mean, everybody seems to be doing membership now, but that was quite a decision that was quite ahead of the curve.
We were very early. The membership, you know, full credit goes to my co-founder, Bola. You know, so his background, actually, while I'm a journalist, he is a digital analyst and then evolved on to being a digital consultant.
Oh, that's a very good match.
Yeah, it's a very good match. And he was specialising in media at his job. And he was looking at how media is being changed, how media is changing and the impact of technology on media. And he was just like, one day, we was having a conversation, he was like, I think we should be a membership. And also, it was fueled by personal ambitions. You know, we had been together for a couple for a very long time. We wanted to kind of take our relationship to the next level. And it was kind of like, we were pouring every bit of money into Black Ballad. But we weren't getting anything in advertising, because advertising, especially back then, was about scale. How big is your audience? And, you know, Black people make up 3% of the country. If Black women make up half of that, that's 1.5%. And then you've got to think about the specific sort of target audience that Black Ballad is targeting in terms of Black women. People didn't see the scale. They didn't see the value. So we kind of knew that advertising was not going to bring us money, especially at that time, because we had a much smaller community then. So Bola was like, the only way we can make money really at this point is to have a membership. And also, I think I had sort of like an advertisement, not a deal, but like a brand gave us some products. And a beauty brand gave us some products, and they weren't very good for Black skin. And I remember writing about it, and the brand has never worked for us again. Okay. And I think that really pushed me actually with the membership, because it made me see that I don't have to rely on brands for money to give Black women an authentic experience. And I think that's very important, especially when we were so small, we didn't really have leverage then to kind of push back with brands. So the membership gave us a sustainable income that didn't rely on brands, but actually put Black women first, in terms of, we have to make the membership the best it is, so Black women actually pay us. And then the flip side of that is, by having a paywall, we're actually protecting Black writers, Black female writers who don't get opportunities to kind of write about their stories or interview people that they want. They get to do that in a safe space as well. So it was kind of personal again, wanting to kind of have a life that didn't kind of revolve around Black Ballad financially. It was knowing that this kind of gave us sustainable income and not being reliant on brands who wanted to kind of use the platform to advertise products that didn't even work for the audience that we were engaging with. So that's why we did it, and we were so early, and if I'm honest, people didn't think it was going to work. I think there was a kind of a thing of like this small independent brand led by a black woman is like having the balls to kind of make people pay for content. People did not think it was going to work. But, 3 years on, we are still standing and the membership has grown so, so much. And it's so funny because the people that didn't think it was going to work, some are members, some of our critics actually love us now. But, I think one thing that Bon and I both agreed on, and I have to be honest, I wasn't keen on a membership at first, actually. We spoke about it for 8 months. But I think we both realised it was going to be better to be early than to be late.
Yes.
And I think that was it. It was like, if we're early, we're early, and we take the criticism, we take the flack. And, the criticism came from... I met with one of my greatest media heroes, and I'm not going to say who it is, and he said, don't do a membership. And I was kind of heartbroken because he is, my journalist idol. And I still had to push against that sort of feeling. Even people in our community were like, I don't think I'll pay for it, if I'm honest. Other critics in the media were kind of like, why would you have a membership? So it was coming from, the criticism for the membership was coming in all directions, thick and fast. But we just went with our gut. We did some focus groups, we did some phone calls, and we had enough reassurance that there were people that was going to buy. And it was a success, and we're still standing 3 years later.
So was it a case that once you launched it, it sort of built slowly, or were you actually surprised at the amount of people that straight away were like, yeah, we will actually support that?
So basically how the membership came about, I should probably go back a few steps. So we launched the membership in like, I want to say October 2016 with an event. And, we just wanted to raise like around like, I think £10,000 was our aim. And we raised about 12.5 when it was all said and done. But, we did a crowdfund campaign and hosted the crowdfund on our own site. And it went really slow at first. And I really thought we'd made a mistake. And then it picked up because we kind of changed tactics. It picked up. But one thing that happened as well was that a lot of people that kind of joined the membership in the crowdfund, they actually dropped off because they didn't quite, I think people bought the membership to support Black Ballad and they weren't utilising it. So we had to kind of go back to the drawing board and be like, okay, what is the content that we've got to make people see that this is an integral part of their daily routine? What are the events that we should be doing? What are the brands that we should be working with? So we kind of spent 2017 really experimenting with different content ideas, different types of events. And I think, we slowly started to build the membership numbers back up over 2017, 2018. And then I think since 2019, it's been on a really great sort of trajectory. And COVID, I have to admit, has really helped the membership numbers increase.
You're not the only one to say that.
Yeah.
How does the directory fit alongside that? Because I guess if you're not reliant on advertising, is that paid for option where people pay to be in it?
Yeah. So brands pay to be in our directory, and then we give our audience, or our paying members, I should say, discounts to the brands in a directory. Our directory is very important to us, actually, because there is the side of media that's all about the consumer that we talk about, and then we talk about like media in terms of who's actually telling the stories. But media functions as a platform to advertise businesses, and Black businesses don't often get those opportunities to advertise to customers because they don't get funding for their businesses to pay the rates that you would get, you'd have to pay to be in a mainstream magazine. So for us, that's our version of, I guess, like advertisement, in terms of we create very fair prices for Black-owned businesses to be in that directory, and hopefully do some content with them and around their business to advertise to our members. And then it doubles up as a nice lifestyle perk. It's nice that Black women or whoever's a member can see this Black-owned business and be like, oh, okay, that's a great product for my hair, or that's a great service, and I can, use my money to kind of pay for that product or service.
And talking of funding, I think you've recently secured, I think it's £70,000 worth of funding from the Future of News project. So yeah. What are you planning to do with that?
Yeah, so with the Future of News project, you know, myself, Bola, and our head of editorial, Jandela Benson, we've always been conscious that we're three Londoners, three black Londoners. And yeah. if Black Ballad is going to, I think, not just survive and thrive, we need to look outside London. And I think one thing that I've been very clear on to the team is that I'm not going to repeat the mistakes of mainstream media. And what I mean by that is there's not going to be one dominant voice in this publication. And that dominant voice is the black female Londoner. And I think, you know, I needed to do a lot of work to kind of undo that. So the £70,000 from the Future of News project, we've got the Black Woman in Britain project, also known as the Outside London project, where we did a survey where we had 3,500 black women fill in information and to answer questions all about their lives up and down the country. And from that data, we have commissioned 9 editors across the country to create content about their area. So for 9 weeks later on in the year, we'll have an editor from a specific region in the country take over Black Ballad with all content from their area. And that is from, you know, we've got an area in Scotland, Wales, you know, the northwest, east of England, southwest, southeast. So we've had 9 new team members for the last, oh God, I'm going to say like 4 to 6 weeks. And it's been amazing. And the stories and content that's being produced, I'm just so excited for it. And I want to be clear, this isn't just kind of like the beginning and the end of us doing, you know, content that really kind of puts the spotlight on black women outside London. It's just the beginning. So that's what we're going to be doing with the money.
Tell me about your takeover of HuffPost last month. Like, how did that come about? Because that looked incredible.
HuffPost came about, you know, in all honesty, there is a fantastic journalist at the Huffington Post called Nadine White, a black female journalist. And she is a Black Ballad member. She's a fantastic journalist. You know, we are friends. And she saw an announcement about our Black Motherhood project that we were doing on Black Ballad. Like the Outside London project, we had done a survey about the habits and I guess like the things that black mothers were going through in January, and we wanted to create content around that. And she saw it in an email and said, like, I think, you know, HuffPost would be interested in this. And she connected us to her lifestyle editor, Nancy Groves. And we had a conversation, myself, Jenny and Bola, with Nancy the day before I went into labour, actually, which is so funny, about doing a takeover with them on Black Motherhood, because they also know how important this subject is. You know, black women are 5 times more likely to die in childbirth in this country, not America. And they knew that this was a pressing issue. They knew that we were very passionate about it. And also, you know, they also understand that we have this audience in a way that they don't. So we spoke about this project, and then I think over the course of like a 2-month period, Jandela Benson led the charge in terms of commissioning black female writers, black mums to be, in creating content that would sit and live on the Huffington Post. And we took over their homepage, their parenting page, their HuffPost UK social channels, their parenting newsletter. And it was an amazing experience to work with the Huffington Post team. It was an amazing experience to have like a bigger budget, to commission writers that wouldn't even get the chance to be on those platforms. So it was great. It was a great experience for us as a small team to work with a much larger team. But most importantly, it was a great experience to make sure black women's stories were told on a platform that was bigger than ours. I think Black Ballad by far is the best platform for black women in Britain. I will always say that. But at the same time, I think, because if I don't believe it, how can I convince anyone to pay for it? You know what Absolutely. I mean? Like, I have to believe it. And I believe that so wholeheartedly that no one can do what we do. But at the same time, I also have to be realistic in terms of we don't have the biggest microphone. And at the end of the day, these are issues that everybody should be talking about. Everybody should be outraged that black women are 5 times more likely to die in childbirth. And media is not doing a good enough job of covering this story. So to have that story on Huffington Post and to have black women's experiences as they're going through pregnancy and childbirth, and kind of really doing some serious journalism on the racist experience that we go through when we're giving when we're going through the pregnancy journey, was so important.
Do you think that's something that HuffPost would have had lessons from that they learned as well? Like, are they, or is this just going to be something they did for a couple of months and then we'll just go back to what they used to do?
No, I don't think so. I think Huffington Post, I think one of the things that we all remarked on was that Huffington Post was so took a back seat. They wanted to learn from us. They wanted to see how we engage and talk to this audience. They are so passionate about supporting us afterwards. And I think that's the one thing that I've been really touched by, that Nancy Groves, Head of Life, and their acting editor-in-chief, Harry Slater, have been so passionate and so committed to supporting Black Ballad after this collaboration. And that's why I think that this isn't just kind of like a vanity project for them. Also, some of the content that they put out through Nadine Wyatt, who is one of my favourite journalists, reassured me that I'd be walking into a partnership that felt like a partnership and not a diversity project for them. So if there's one publication that I am very confident in terms of, you know, making sure that Black voices are heard, is the Huffington Post.
I assume there have been benefits for you guys in terms of sort of audience, hopefully some memberships.
Yeah, so we there was memberships. There was sales and memberships, which is always great. It accounted for about 75% of that week's memberships through Huffington Post.
Wow.
And obviously great awareness for us. But the thing I think I didn't take into consideration, if I'm honest, that which it did, it validated us to a lot of people in media. And, you know, when you're doing these collaborations, I don't think, especially because it's such a serious topic, you don't think about other people's opinions. And with Black and with media, it has always been centered on the opinions of white people. And I created a media platform to be the complete opposite to that. And Huffington Post gave us validation with an industry that is dominated by white people. And I guess that's great. It's great for us. I'd be interested to see those who loved it and, you know, gave validation on social media, follow it up, if I'm honest. But it gave us validation, which I guess is never a bad thing.
And more widely, have you found since founding it that British media or you know, media more widely, has it got better at serving Black communities, or is the change kind of a bit more superficial?
I think it's gotten better, but I don't think it's anywhere where it should be. I think, you know, like for a long time, I was a freelancer. Like even when I was doing Black Ballad and people loved my work, you know, I still couldn't get a full-time job within the office. And that says, and I'm going to be honest, I think that says a lot. Like, it says a lot that, like, you can create a whole platform, a whole membership, and people still see you just as a freelancer that they can kind of wheel out when they want. And I know that this whole idea of being a freelancer that kind of gets called for the Black issue is very common among Black journalists in the UK, Black female journalists. It's not just a me issue. It's not just a me sort of, I guess people might say, a thing in my head. There is a conversation amongst Black female journalists in particular that publications only reach out to them when they want a race issue, and not many of us, or not nearly as many that need to be, are in the offices. And that is why I don't think it is where it needs to be. And I also think the fact that we are still doing diversity schemes, it just is so telling. It's just so telling that we're still having to do diversity schemes to get Black and brown people through the door of newsrooms. Is, you know, 2020, as an industry, we should feel a lot of shame about it. We should. You know, how many Black editors do we have in the country?
Like, well, the ones we do have still get profiled by security at the door.
Yeah, you know, Edward Enfield is like the Black editor that everybody knows and loves. And, you know, it's great that we have him, but, you know, I think many of us would struggle to go to double digits. I think we really would. And again, in 2020, it's pretty pitiful. And the fact that, you know, the statistic that media is 94% white has been around for years, and we're still doing diversity schemes, we're still treating Black female writers as disposable freelancers. Yeah, I don't think it's anywhere where it needs to be. But as I said, I think there are some publications that are trying to do a much better job of incorporating Black writers and race issues into their content.
And when you were looking at the next sort of, I don't know, next 5 years in media, I know that's difficult for anybody to think of past the end of this year, but what are your plans for Black Ballad for the next sort of 5 years?
I'll be honest, the first thing is keeping it afloat during COVID and such uncertain economic times.
Yeah,
what is my first thought for the next 5 years of Black Ballad? That is my first thought. I think any business owner that's not thinking about how to navigate their business and pivot their business to surviving COVID should not be a business owner.
Because I mean, so the content's still vitally important, isn't it? Because if you look at the statistics of black people and coronavirus in this country,
yep.
they need specific and dedicated information, right?
They do. And, you know, a great example is, you know, pre-existing conditions that the media was talking about, you know, like, don't, you know, if you have this condition, don't go out. Nobody was talking about sickle cell, which is, you know, a health crisis that affects black people. So we do need that content more than ever, because mainstream media is not putting out that content. And that's just one tiny example. So navigating the choppy waters of COVID is my first sort of first port of call. And I think after that, it will be the regional expansion, keeping the regional content and engagement from black women outside London. 50% of our membership are actually not in London. So I'm really dedicated to making sure we keep that relationship with black women outside London engaged and deep, and also grow it. Of course, in the next 5 years, of course, I'm thinking about international expansion. You know, in Europe alone, like, what publications are for black women? There's hardly anything. And I think Black Ballad has a real shot of dominating black media in Europe. And I believe we're best placed to.
We ask all our guests, what's the last thing is you read or watched or listened to? Something that you saw that really affected you?
Something that has inspired me recently is the Netflix documentary, The Last Dance. The documentary followed Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls last season in their quest for their sixth NBA championship. I watched the documentary while I was on maternity leave, and it really inspired me, especially Michael Jordan's work ethic and the things that motivated him to be a champion and to be the best at what he was doing. And obviously, he was a basketball player. So that just gave me some much needed motivation while I wasn't working. To keep on going and to keep on going and aiming to be the best in everything that I do.
If you have enjoyed this week's episode, then don't forget you can get daily content from the Media Voices team. You can go to voices.media and sign up for our daily newsletter. It contains 4 curated stories, which we think are the most important ones for that day. So there's no endless scrolling as you try to digest everything in one long go. And it includes a link to this week's episode and a couple of other links as well, including one to our Peter.
If you've enjoyed this newsletter and all the other stuff that we do, then you can go along to our Ko-fi page, which is linked from our website and from Twitter every now and again, and give us some cash. Basically,
it was. It sounds so mercenary when you say it like that.
Give us some money, man. You think we do this for fun? Jesus. Seriously, we love people donating for obvious reasons, but it's not just the money, it's also the appreciation. We love it. Thank you so much.
And you can see more of what we do over on our website, which has got all our analysis. It's got transcripts of all the interviews that go up a few days after the interview goes live. It's got links to support us, links to the newsletter, pretty much all the links you need. That's voices.media. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Media Voices Pod, where we post the daily news as we go through the week.
And we'll soon be on TikTok.
What? Yeah. I'm too old for TikTok.
But until next week, when we'll be back with a fantastic guest and another tour through that week's media news and views, thank you very much for listening and stay safe.
Good luck, TikTok.
China!